You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by purchasing a cell phone case from Crossway, crossweh.com/LPR. You'll find cell phone cases for Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, and Luther's Seal with the Reformation Solas. crossweh.com/LPR. A percentage of your purchase will support Issues Etc. crossweh.com/LPR. Girls will be boys and boys will be girls. It's a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world. It's a
muddled up. Have we reached a tipping point? The rise of transgender ideology caught many off guard. It was rapid, and it seemed to have popped up everywhere in academia, in medical associations. We suddenly discovered transition centers for adolescents all over the country. So how did all of that happen so quickly? But as I asked, have we reached a tipping point where perhaps at least only legally to begin with, those who are transitioning are saying, I was misled, I was mistreated, maybe there was medical malpractice. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Monday afternoon, the 4th of March. We're going to talk about gender ideology and detransitioning. Jennifer Law will join us then. Hadley Arkus will be alongside. He says we need to refocus the abortion debate. He says there's a very simple, basic way to do it. Just make everyone agree on what they're willing to do with the unborn legally. Jennifer Lowell has spent 25 years as a pediatric critical care nurse, a hospital administrator, and a senior-level nursing manager. She's founder of the Center for Bioethics and Culture Network and director and executive producer of the films The Lost Boys and The Detransition Diaries. She's co-author of a new book also titled The Detransition Diaries. Jennifer, welcome back.
It's good to be back with you, Todd.
How did you find yourself pulled into the gender transition issue?
Yeah. Most of my films that you just mentioned were all in the space of, you know, what we call big fertility. And when I learned that children, before they are put on puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones because they think they're born in the wrong body, these children, young adults, are being offered fertility preservation. So they're being offered, would you like to freeze and bank your sperm and or your eggs so that when you grow up, you might still be able to have children that are biologically related. So when I learned that these children were having their own fertility destroyed in this transgender ideological space of medicine, and I use the term medicine pretty loosely, I just said, that's it. So we produce now 3 films in the transgender space. Most recently, The Lost Boys just came out last month, Searching for Manhood, which is on 5 men who detransitioned, who thought they were women. And during the production of our film, The Detransition Diaries, which was released last year on young women, Ignatius Press asked us if we would write a book. The book came out on Valentine's Day. It will always be easy for me to remember when the book came out, that really looks at what's going on with our young people, predominantly in the United States here, that are being fed the lie that they've been born in the wrong body.
Why are adolescent girls especially susceptible to transgender ideology?
You know, with young girls, they're much more social creatures and much more influenced by what their peers are doing. I always joke girls kind of run in packs. And if 2 of the young girls are wearing the hair a particular way, then they want to wear their hair that way. We know that young girls are more at risk for things like eating disorders, bulimia, anorexia. They're more at risk of self-harm, cutting, things like that, that are harmful behaviors. So this new gender ideological movement is just one more way that young girls are being influenced. And the internet, obviously, you know, these young girls, in particular boys too, spend way too much time looking at social influencers that are gender fluid, gender queer, non-binary, and they're just really influenced. They call it a social contagion.
Why do we need to maintain several points, beginning with that biological sex is real?
Well, you know, I was a nurse for many, many years, and biology and being able to know if you're dealing with a man or a woman is really important in being able to diagnose treatments and make decisions on therapy or surgical interventions. You know, if you have a young person that presents in an emergency room and they identify as a man, but they're actually a female, and they present with abdominal pain, you might not be looking for, say, perhaps the fact that this person might be having an ectopic pregnancy. Just for being able to properly practice good medicine, it's important to know if we're dealing with a biological man or just a man or a woman. I do think it's important, too, to not lie. And if we look at a man and he tells us that he's a woman, I'm not one of those people that's going to be overly concerned with hurting feelings, because I'm going to be reality-based in realizing that I'm addressing a man and not a woman.
Can someone change his or her sex?
Absolutely not. It's an illusion. Sure, you can modify your body. Young girls have had double mastectomies. They talk about young girls and young boys having what they call bottom surgery, sexual reassignment surgery. But your DNA is still what it is, man or woman. You know, I always say if there's a crime scene and the only evidence is blood, the police officers are going to know if they're looking for a man or a woman who committed the crime, not what the person identified. So you can't change your sex. A man can never be a woman. A woman can never be a man.
Is gender dysphoria real?
Yeah, there's some debate that, you know, the term gender dysphoria is relatively new. The word gender is relatively new. You know, we used to talk about sex. People would be pregnant and announce that they're having a boy or a girl. Like, you know, now you even see people saying they have gender reveal parties. You know, gender is really a kind of a nebulous word, but I would probably like more comfortably using the word body dysmorphia. These are people that are uncomfortable in their body. You know, many people have some element of body dysmorphia. You know, we gain weight over the holidays and we look in the mirror and we go, oh my, I look awful. I need to go on a diet. But this is an extreme discomfort. So it is real. I guess I would just be much more comfortable using the phrase body dysmorphia, since I think gender is a word that really needs to be buried and not used much anymore.
How should this body dysphoria, how should it properly be treated? We're going to talk a lot about how it is being mistreated.
Sure. And to be honest, most of these people, young children, young adults that have these feelings of discomfort in their bodies, they have many other comorbidities. You know, you think about the COVID pandemic, and we were told over and over again that people were more at risk for having a severe case of COVID, if you will, if they had comorbidities. They were diabetic, they were elderly, they were overweight. And the same is true with this patient population. A lot of these children are on the autistic spectrum. One of the young boys in our recent film, The Lost Boys, you know, he had really bad OCD. A lot of these children have past trauma. And one of the young girls that I've interviewed, as a very young girl, she lost a really important close caregiver. And her family was the type of family that just didn't talk about death or losing people. It was just sort of swept under the rug. And that caused her a lot of just stress. A lot of these children are, like I said, they're spending way too much time on the internet and being influenced by pornography. Pornography use is high. So you have to look at all these other things that are going on in these young people's lives that's causing them this kind of distress. And those are the things that medicine, psychiatry, counseling should be addressing and dealing with, and not feeding into the lie that they've been born in the wrong body. And if they transition, in quotes, that all of their problems will be solved. And all of my research and all of my filmmaking in detransitioners is that was the missing link, was that the root problems were never addressed.
What are so-called gender-affirming treatments? Tell us about how this usually proceeds.
Yeah, it starts by just affirming that the child, yes, is indeed born in the wrong body. So say you have a little boy and he announces he's a little girl. So gender affirmation begins with saying, okay, he's now told us he's a little girl and we're going to treat him like a little girl. You know, they do social transition things, like they change your name. Tommy becomes Susie. They change their pronouns. I'm no longer he, him. I'm she, her. And then if they choose to go beyond the social transition of, you know, name changing, pronoun changing, dressing a particular way, then they are put on a medical path. And that can be, depending on the age of the child, early on where they actually stop the puberty development of the child, which I think is just medical malpractice, all the way to putting them on opposite sex hormones. So little boys are put on high dose estrogen, little girls are put on high dose testosterone. And then the path forward, if they want to go on and have the surgical interventions, which again, I think doctors that are in the business of medicalizing and surgicalizing these distressed people ought to have their licenses revoked.
What are the dangers of these gender-affirming treatments?
Well, the first danger is you're just not addressing the true underlying problems, which are these psychological problems these children have. And you're feeding into the delusion and the lie that they are born in the wrong body. There's plenty in the medical literature about actually how harmful it is for, you know, male and female bodies to take the wrong doses of hormones in their own bodies. You know, when you think about a man who's trying to present as a woman, he has to take very, very high dose estrogen. And the same is true of women taking high dose testosterone. And these, if you can imagine, you know, women's bodies were never meant to have these levels of testosterone, you know, flowing through our bloodstream 24/7, you know, and the same is true with men. And so there's all kinds of complications as far as heart disease and bone loss and brain fog. And, you know, it just attacks all systems of our bodies, from our, you know, our heart, our circulatory system, our neurological system, and our, you know, our bone development and our bone health. The surgeries, again, these are irreversible surgeries, and the long-term complications, if I'm trying to be friendly to an audience on the radio, this is sort of PG-13 discussions to have. But, you know, if you can imagine having, you know, your female or your male genitalia removed and refashioned into the opposite sex, these are people that live with lifelong complications. Again, they've lost their ability to procreate, to have a family. I've interviewed several young women who've had double mastectomies who have now detransitioned and realize that if they're able to have children, they'll never be able to breastfeed their children. So, you know, these are consequences that have lifelong impacts. These people are basically patients for life.
How did the gender affirming movement begin?
Well, we were fortunate in the book that we were asked to write, The Detransition Diaries, to be able to sort of take people back and look at historically what happened and medically what happened. And so we identify in the book, in one of the early chapters, that this kind of thinking has been around for quite some time. It was certainly never mainstream like it was now. But back in the early 1900s, we have the first man who decided he was a woman who actually had a uterine transplant. And this gentleman, of course, died of complications of that surgery, and it was never able to be successful. And there was just always a movement within medicine and the social science. We looked at Alfred Kinsey and the work that Kinsey did, really blurring the distinctions between men and women. We looked at John Money at Johns Hopkins, who early on is quite famous or infamous for the abuse that he did on the two Reimer twins, a little pair of twin boys. You know, one of the young boys, as a newborn, had a really horrible accident in just a routine circumcision where his male genitalia was removed accidentally. And so John Money at Johns Hopkins used them as a social experiment and said, we're just going to raise this little boy as if he was a little girl. And both of these boys were abused terribly by John Money, and both of them ended up committing suicide as young men. Quite tragic. And there was just a lot that was going on. You know, I often talk to audiences and say, you know, we used to have women's studies, and then women's studies in academics settings moved into gender studies, and then it moved into queer studies, and now we have queer studies. And so, you know, the whole academy was also captured. So it was medicine, it was the academy, all these ideas that, you know, women are no different than men. And women being no different than men means that we're the same, means that we're interchangeable. And so here we are, where people actually are trying to force us to agree that a man can be a woman. I live in California. You know, Caitlyn Jenner, who used to be Bruce Jenner, you know, ran for the governor. And I'm sorry, I will never be able to call Caitlyn Jenner a woman. But that's what, you know, society says. If we don't do that, we're being rude or hurtful. and we might lose our jobs.
You talked about the various studies that universities have adopted, gender studies and the like. How did gender affirming, how did that movement become mainstreamed in medicine and in academia?
In the United States, you know, medicine is pretty much governed by the medical society. So the American Academy of Pediatrics, for example, or the American Endocrine Society, or what's called WPATH, W-P-A-T-H, which is an international society that has sort of set the guidelines. And this is a small group of people that have wielded a lot of influence. So when you look at the United States, there's tens of thousands of pediatricians that are just practicing in their little pediatric offices across the country. But it's, you know, a hand-picked group of, say, 30 or 50 people that run the American Academy of Pediatrics. And they set the standards, they set the guidelines, and they have been totally captured. And we talk about in the book many past examples of where medicine went terribly wrong. You know, we outline what happened in Nazi Germany with the Nuremberg trials that looked at the ways that people were being treated and being experimented on. We looked at the Tuskegee syphilis studies in the United States. We looked at the lobotomy studies, and we looked at the mass involuntary sterilization program we had across the United States, where doctors were really doing all kinds of things that are not medicine. And so this is just one more point in time where ideas have captured medicine at the level of their professional societies. And from the top down, they're saying, this is the standard of care. So if you have a little boy or a little girl that presents in your office who thinks they are born in the wrong body, this is how you're supposed to treat that person. And I think physicians have been, one, they've been afraid. We've seen that in past experiments across history where doctors aren't brave enough to speak out and say, this is wrong. And they're afraid of being sued, because if you're not following the guidelines that your professional body is saying you should be following, then you could be at risk of being sued. But there's cracks. And I think it was just last week, the Endocrine Society said that they're going to be reviewing their guidelines. We have lawsuits. We have three big lawsuits in my state, California, against Kaiser Permanente, one of the biggest insurance providers. And they've all been filed by detransitioners. So, you know, we end the book by saying what's going to happen is we're going to have whistleblowers, and we're going to have lawsuits, and we're going to have a public outcry. And we're at that tipping point, Todd, because we have the lawsuits now in the United States. There's quite a few across the country, but there's three in my state. We've already had quite a few whistleblowers. Most recently, a physician down in Texas has become quite a big whistleblower. And parents are really organizing and saying, you know, we're not going to let you do this to our children anymore.
Jennifer Lall is our guest. We're talking about transgender ideology and detransitioning. We'll hear some stories of detransition next.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry cares for pregnant women sharing the love of Christ. Listen to Pastor Ed DeWitt with Redeeming Life Outreach Ministries.
One of the first residents we had said to me, Pastor, why do you do this? And I said, just stick with me through this class, and when we're done, you'll understand completely. Many of the women, as they go through the instruction, when we get to that part about baptism, they're like, Pastor, I want that for my baby. I want my baby to be adopted into God's family.
God's mission here, lcms.org/national mission.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
A number of people have asked about Ad Crucem's process to order our faux stained glass window clings. It's easy. Email us with your window's dimensions, the images you require, and the style you like, and we will quote to design, print, and ship your window clings to you. We recommend having them professionally installed. If you wish to purchase a sample, we have a gorgeous small Luther Rose cling available on the website. Pop on over to adcrucem.com. That's adcrucem.com.
Our Christian faith is under constant attack, and we must be proactive in keeping our children in the church. At Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas, we believe that an education rooted in God's Word is one that stands against the very gates of hell. Nothing in this world is more important. Offering a rigorous classical Lutheran education, we provide in-person and live online remote learning opportunities for preschool through grade 12. To learn more, visit flsplano.org, flsplano.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about gender ideology and detransitioning with Jennifer Lowell, founder of the Center for Bioethics and Culture Network. Lutherans for Life invites you to the Lutheran Adoption Conference, April 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. You'll find additional information at lutheransforlife.org/conferences, lutheransforlife.org/conferences. Jennifer, tell us some of the stories of detransition.
They're just heartbreaking. You know, I think of Grace is one woman that we interviewed in the Detransition Diaries, and she described herself in high school and college as a social justice warrior, very involved with the LGBTQ plus group at college, and spent way too much time on the internet and, you know, just got wrapped into this ideology that this is the way to be. And she changed her name, changed her pronouns. She went on and had a double mastectomy, was on high-dose testosterone. And what she realized is that none of her distress went away. You know, she was told, if you do all these things, you'll be much more comfortable with who you are and in your own body. And we see that theme over and over again. These kids have all kinds of, you know, like I said, comorbidities, distress, and they're told that this is, you know, the panacea. And Grace is one of the successful stories because she did detransition. In the movie, The Detransition Diaries, we show pictures of her at her wedding, where she's in her beautiful wedding dress with her husband in his, you know, beautiful suit. And she's also one that just recently had a baby. She's been quite active on social media and been open about talking about the fact that how sad she is that she can't nurse her baby. In the male side of them, one of the young men that we interviewed in The Lost Boys, Brian, he had a serious drug and alcohol and pornography addiction issue. And, you know, he was just going nowhere fast. He was spiraling out of control and not getting better. And he was in and out of treatment programs and in and out of rehab programs. But they were all social justice kind of programs that were all affirming him. And he finally broke away and found one therapy group that actually dealt with his underlying issues. You know, they dealt with his drug and alcohol problems. And then he woke up and realized, I'm a man. But he has permanently probably destroyed his fertility from years and years of high-dose estrogen. He says in the film how he's lost his rugged masculine look. But yeah, it's stories of being not properly cared for, but being able to wake up one day and realize that everything they told me that would help me hasn't helped me, and I'm still no better off. And then being able to unravel and peel back and, you know, reclaim their true self.
Why are detransitioning stories and those who tell them often suppressed by the LGBTQ community?
It doesn't fit the narrative. I often say that the transgender radical activists, they're not satisfied unless we all just celebrate and embrace the gender affirmation ideological movement. And they will not tolerate dissenters. When we were in pre-production of the Detransition Diaries, Grace, one of the women I just mentioned, was on a 60-minute segment that was about transgender health in America. It featured a lot of otherwise seemingly happy transition people. And one segment that Leslie Stahl interviewed about five detransitioners, and the backlash was so fast and furious against Leslie Stahl and 60 Minutes for daring to include these people's voices. And that's when we said we really need to amplify their voices because they're growing. And, you know, there's a lot more detransitioners that aren't speaking out because they're afraid. They see this backlash. They see the vitriol that comes after them for not being, you know, happy cheerleaders for the transgender movement. But it's just this intolerance for anything that doesn't toe the party line narrative that, you know, a man can be a woman and a woman can be a man, and this will make everybody happy and solve all your problems. They just can't countenance that there is any dissent. A lot of the detransitioners are then accused, well, you really weren't transgender. You just thought you were. Because if you were truly transgender, then you wouldn't have detransitioned.
Tell us about critics of transgender ideology that we're finding now increasingly in the gay community and in the feminist community.
Yeah, there's groups like, you know, a new group that's become quite organized and outspoken called Gays Against Groomers. You know, the thinking is that a lot of these children are just same-sex attracted and that we just leave them alone. There's the concern that if you're a little boy and you're a feminine little boy who likes to play with dolls or likes to cook or likes to sing, that they're just told, okay, well, you must be a girl then because you like things that girls do, instead of just letting them be feminine little boys or little girls that are tomboys. So there's that concern as well as just that we're meddling. You know, there's a concern that in particularly in women who identify as lesbian, they're being told that they should be romantically involved with men who identify as women. And if they don't tolerate being in a romantic relationship with a man who's presenting as a woman, then they're a transphobe and they're a bigot, when in fact, no, I'm a woman who's not sexually attracted to a male-bodied a man. So I think that's what's really gotten the LGB group. They're wanting to separate themselves from the T and the Q and the plus and to say, we are biologically men, we're biologically female, and we just happen to be attracted to the same sex.
Who are the voices in medicine who are questioning transgender ideology?
Oh, there's so many heroes out there. Our first film called Transmission, What's the Rush to Reassign Gender? We actually sat down and interviewed quite a few physicians because we know that they're out there and they're really putting their neck, if you will, on the chopping block by being so outspoken. Dr. Paul Hughes is one such giant who's at Washington University in St. Louis, who's an MD, PhD, pediatric endocrinologist doctor, who actually started early on by trying to stop Washington University from opening up a pediatric gender clinic and was unsuccessful. But, you know, lo and behold, just this past year, they have closed down their transgender clinic that was taking care of pediatric patients because of a big whistleblower. And they realize that they're putting their staff at liability risk because of the lawsuits that are climbing. Dr. Quentin Van Meter is another hero. He's a private practice pediatric endocrinologist down in the Atlanta, Georgia area. There's quite a few wonderful physicians out there, as well as good therapists too, who just want to really help these children and help these families who are struggling with a child who thinks that they're born in the wrong body. There's plenty of unsung heroes out there who are risking their careers. You know, they're not being asked to speak. Quentin Van Meter talks about being invited to do grand rounds at university hospitals and then having them cancel him because they found out he's not a gender affirmation practicing physician. And I do think, you know, we know that courage begets courage. As more and more people speak out, you know, more and more people become part of the team and go, yeah, I'm going to stand up too and say this is wrong and it has to stop.
You mentioned earlier that a legal cottage industry will be growing up around the detransitioning and medical malpractice. What do you think that future looks like? Has it already begun?
Well, I think the future will look a couple good things that I see happening. One is like what's happening down in Texas, for example, where they're actually trying to pass legislation that will require insurance providers to provide care for those who want to detransition. Using Grace as the example, her insurance provided for her to have a double mastectomy, so to have her healthy breasts removed. But if she wanted to have reconstructive surgery, her insurance won't cover that. So she has to pay for that. So there's a movement that's putting pressure on insurance providers to not just do this destructive surgical procedures on these people. But if and when these people decide to detransition, then the insurance has to provide for their ongoing health. So I think that's a hopeful sign. Another thing that I thought was very hopeful to me as a nurse is the state of Florida. So far, the way that this is being battled, it's a state-by-state battle. And, you know, more conservative red states are passing legislation that says, we can't do this in the state to minors. You know, if you're a minor child, you cannot have your puberty blocked. You can't be put on cross-sex hormones. You can't have surgeries. The Florida way that they handled it, which I thought was brilliant, was the medical professional societies of Florida said, this is not how we're going to practice medicine in Florida. And I think that's a much better way because medicine is taking the high road for their profession and saying, this is not proper medicine. We're not going to do that. And they're not at risk for the legislators are always changing. You know, people get voted in, voted out of office. Governor DeSantis won't be there forever. A new sheriff comes to town, and then we know that the laws can change. But I think when the good physicians say, this is how proper medicine is going to be practiced, and that gender affirmation stuff is not proper medicine, we're not doing it, is a really bright, hopeful way for me to see how states and physicians can handle this.
What would you say to parents of a young person with this body dysphoria?
Well, a couple things. First, you always want to make sure that your kids know that you're on their team. You hear them, you understand their struggles, you care about them more than anybody else. So that's the affirmation, right? The affirmation that you love your child unconditionally. You're in this together. You're going to get them the help that they need so they can be comfortable with how they were born, how God made them, how they were created. The second thing is I always tell people, get your kids off the internet. Guard the amount of harmful, dangerous things that these children have 24/7 access to is just staggering. You know, one of the young girls I've spoken to, she said as a 9-year-old, she said, I had access to pornography nobody should see, let alone a 9-year-old. So get your kids off the internet, really monitor what they're able to see online. Pay attention to who their friends are and the messages. You know, is your child in a public school where you're worried that teachers are doing things behind your back? You know, that's been a big concern, is that parents aren't told that their child at school is being affirmed and at school they're being allowed to use a new name and go by different pronouns. And that's being kept behind the back. So, you know, it's just being vigilant. Get your kids outside so that they are, their friends are real friends that you know these families, you know, the kids who your kids are playing with versus the online community. They think all these people that they don't even know, but they're in a group online that those are their friends.
Jennifer Lall spent 25 years as a pediatric critical care nurse, a hospital administrator, and a senior level nursing manager. She's founder of the Center for Bioethics and Culture Network, director and executive producer of the films The Lost Boys and The Detransition Diaries, and she's co-author of a new book also titled The Detransition Diaries. You'll find a link to this book and to these films at issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, Hadley Arkus says, yes, Republicans have been spooked by several things post-Dobbs, but he has a way of refocusing the abortion debate. We'll find out what it is next.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by purchasing a cell phone case from Crossway, crossweh.com/LPR. You'll find cell phone cases for Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, and Luther's Seal with the Reformation Solas, crossweh.com/LPR. A percentage of your purchase will support Issues Etc., crossweh.com/LPR.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod cares deeply for those who protect our nation. Are you or a loved one currently serving? Ministry to the Armed Forces would like to help. We provide devotional literature to encourage faith. Send your mailing address to lcmschaps@lcms.org or call us at 314-996-1337. Those in uniform are comforted with Psalm 28. The Lord is my strength and my shield. My heart trusts in Him and He helps me.
Teaching your student to read should not be complicated. Memoria Press's phonics uses common sense and the classical approach with their First Start Reading program for the most effective and efficient way to teach your child how to read. If you're interested in learning more, visit them at memoriapress.com and use the coupon code LPR24 at checkout. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
The characteristic mark of hope is that it always looks into the future, so says Hermann Zasse in the March issue of the Lutheran Witness, which is all about hope and overcoming the quiet despair with which we are so in danger of being overcome in these days. To find out more about hope, what Christian hope looks like, and what it means to be a hopeful community, pick up your copy of the March issue of the Lutheran Witness. Visit cph.org/witness or witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
At the center of our campus is Kramer Chapel, and there's a reason for that.
Issues Etc. guest Dr. Arthur Just.
Because it is the heartbeat of Concordia Theological Seminary. It is where we go to hear the voice of Jesus and frequently be fed with the body and blood of Christ. We sometimes call it our Jerusalem. Kramer Chapel points to the classroom, which we sometimes call Athens. It is there that we do theology, biblical studies, systematic theology, practical theology, history. We love theology here, and we love the study of it, and we love coming together in worship. It's one of the things that gives us great joy. Joy in worshiping, joy in studying theology. Concordia Theological Seminary is all about the joy of being in Jesus.
Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, ctsfw.edu.